Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start. All Future Thinkers episodes are now on video. To watch the premiere of each episode and join the discussion live, subscribe to our YouTube channel at FutureThinkers.org/YouTube. Hey guys, welcome back to Future Thinkers Podcast. Our guest today is Joe Brewer, the Executive Director at the Center of Applied Cultural Evolution, complexity researcher, cognitive scientist, and evangelist for regenerative culture design. We invited Joe onto the show because we felt that our ideas about adult development, rites of passage, and overcoming the chasm of nihilism strongly resonated with his thinking and his work on cultural evolution.
This interview is very dense, and we talk about a lot of subjects that are pretty complex, so we divided the episode into two parts. This is part one, where we talk about what kind of education we need in order to prepare for an evolutionary transition, why even intellectuals can't wrap their heads around climate change, and the importance of the grieving process for psychological and spiritual maturing. You can find all the links and mentions and the show notes at futurethinkers.org/90. Our new course, The Ancient Art of Adulting, is here. Adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org.
So yeah, it's interesting. We've been watching a bunch of your videos recently, and there are a bunch of strange synchronicities around the stuff that you talk about and the stuff that we've also been exploring.
Yeah, especially lately.
Yeah. Like the kind of advanced adult development, crossing the chasm of nihilism into kind of the integral second tier thinking, rites of passage, finding what is sacred to you in order to deal with kind of the overwhelming grief of planetary collapse. A lot of the very similar approaches. So it was really, really interesting just in the last couple of days watching your videos and being like, yeah, he's talking about the same stuff. Yeah,
it's a strange cool. thing to feel like applauding a conversation like this. Like, oh, I'm so glad you're talking about this too. Oh wait,
The world's falling apart. Oh, let's chat about that. It's so exciting.
Yeah, I remember reading this very good book. I think it was a Reader's Digest book, and it came out in the late '60s or early '70s in the U.S. called "The Disappearance of Childhood," and it was about how consumer marketing and sitcoms on television were role modeling children as miniature adults. Meaning if you saw a child actor performing on a TV sitcom, the scripted lines were adult language. They weren't the cognitive patterns of a child. And this was in conjunction with the rise of marketing, which tries to treat everyone developmentally at the stage of early adolescence. The ideal place to have an impulsive consumer with a foundational insecurity, enough privilege to be able to act as a consumer, but not enough responsibility to have constraint. And you can really see the absence of adulthood decades later from this. It's quite fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. And then combined with the way that the educational system has panned out over the last several decades, which Jonathan Haidt talks about in his book, that it has become overly postmodernist, but in a way that where people aren't actually doing the investigation themselves, where they're deconstructing concepts and understanding why, you know, things aren't quite as solid as they appear. They're just being spoon-fed this deconstructionist mindset without actually having previously learned why systems work in the first place, why logic works, you know, why hierarchies work. And they're basically trying to jump across the stage of development, and it's a complete disaster because now people are just incapable of thinking and they're regressing to this tribalist mentality.
You just described the field of professional economics, which operates as though thermodynamics isn't a real thing. We can just have infinite growth of the economy. It's fine. It's like, time out. Have you not heard of empirical materialism? Like, there is a real world and it has constraints. Yeah. So yes, it's a very big problem that you can see developmentally in individuals and developmentally in terms of the overall capacity for discernment and management of an entire society. So yeah, both levels, it's a very big issue.
So yeah, big problem. So how do you approach it? How have you approached it personally? And maybe let's rewind a little bit. How did you come to recognize this problem from your own background? And then how do you approach it personally?
So I often like to start my story by saying that I was born and raised on a chicken farm in rural Missouri in the middle of the United States. And I say that because I grew up in a place that had pretty low education, had a lot of violence and abuse, alcoholism and drug use. And I grew up before the internet. So that meant that I was starved for knowledge. I remember a time hearing about Buddhism and trying to find a library with a single book on Buddhism and traveling to 10 different public libraries before I found my first book. So it was like knowledge-starved sort of environment. When I went to university, I had a full-ride academic scholarship, meaning I could study whatever I wanted, and I didn't really care about getting a degree. I just thought, 4 years paid for college, what do I want to learn? And because I was approaching it from a passion for learning, whereas most people were approaching it as job training, I felt this very profound disconnect between trying to understand how the world works and preparing for a job in the future. This kind of disconnect between me and a lot of the other people at the university. And this was a big schism because as a child growing up, I in seventh grade, all of my friends that I'd grown up with were held back because they had failing grades. So I went to eighth grade and they all stayed back in seventh grade. When they turned 16, all of my childhood friends dropped out of high school because that was the age where they could legally do that in the state of Missouri. So I had this experience of growing up in a place where knowledge was not really valued and feeling a very personal schism within my social world about this. I had thought when I went to university that it would be different. I'd get to university and this is a place where people who love to learn, well, wouldn't they be the ones who choose to stay in school? And I was really shocked to find that, you know, it's hard to put a number. I wasn't being rigorous, but it seemed like, you know, 95% of the students at university were not there because of a passion for learning. It was more that they were there because it was the next step in whatever their story of growing up was supposed to be. So in some ways, my journey to the work that I do now has come from a responsibility that I felt at a personal level. The more that I learned and the more privilege and opportunity I had, like having a full ride scholarship to go to university after being a poor working class kid on a farm, I felt a really big gift had been bestowed upon me by my society. And I learned a lot of really valuable things. So I felt like they needed to be given back in some way. And even that kind of ethical character of responsibility was largely absent. It wasn't being taught. And I think I learned it mostly from studying martial arts as a teenager, where, you know, being a body-based practice, the only way to prove that you've done something is to demonstrate it with your body. So it's not a superficial check the boxes, you know, multiple choice exam where you could kind of fake it and not really know things. With martial arts, you have to know things to demonstrate them to get to the next level. So I guess I'm kind of painting a picture of a broad set of life experiences early on that brought me to this place. I don't know if that gets at it closely enough, but it maybe is a context to build from.
Interesting, the kind of character development that is involved in growing up in a place where you're not surrounded by intellectuals in your ideal kind of community. And it seems like almost that separation or that schism between what you felt you were and what the rest of the society was kind of drove you further down the path that you went down.
There's so many parallels with how both of us grew up as well. Like I grew up on a farm with chickens in Russia, in rural Russia. And Mike grew up in a small town in Canada where there was also a lot of alcoholism and people dropping out of high school and not caring at all.
Yep.
Yeah, and both of us studied martial arts as well.
In some ways, the martial arts were really a godsend, like an absolute gift, because once I started to use my body as my compass, as my wayfinding device, that I would come to discern things based on how they felt in my body. And I know like Jordan Greenhall and Daniel Schmottenberger are among the group of people who really recognize sense-making in the body, kind of the cybernetic or semiotic perspective, as being really essential. I came to that wholly by accident. I was a goofy, uncoordinated kid with anger problems, with two older brothers in a similar situation. My mom put us in martial arts, so we would stop fighting, and so I wouldn't trip over my shoelaces. And so I didn't get put on that path to become a discerning and capable adult. That wasn't the conscious intention, but it was very much the outcome. And a really interesting design perspective to reconstruct that piece of it and then think about how to help others.
So let's talk about the next part of the story. What did you study and what are you working on now?
Let me start with where my studies began. Because I went to a university with 4 years of a kind of blank check, could study whatever I wanted, and I had the full-ride academic scholarship called the Governor's Scholarship at my university. It was a small university in Missouri. And what that meant was I could break the rules. I could go to a professor and say, I don't have the prerequisites for your class, but I'd still like to take it. I'm a Governor's Scholar, so I'm capable of doing it. And it was a way for me to get permission to get out of the normal rules. And one of the problems of this was I couldn't really have mentors academically. Pretty quickly after this, because my path was so unlike traditional academic paths. But I was very interested in the beginning in theater, physics, and philosophy. So I was dabbling in these three areas that at a deep level are very much connected, but at a surface level, it's hard to see their connection. So I was training to become something of an applied philosopher without knowing that's what I was doing. So I was learning physics and math, philosophy, and philosophy in many ways was the history of physics and math. So unlike my fellow students in a physics class like quantum mechanics, I would know about the Vienna Circle in Austria in 1850 when positivism started, where they had this big debate about what is real and knowable. They had a whole year-long debate about whether zero should be included in formal mathematics. And they came down on a pragmatic position. Zero is essential for defining the limiting function in calculus. And so we can't hold up physics as a pedestal for a positivist science and not have calculus. So we have to keep zero. So if you don't know that history and you're learning calculus and quantum mechanics, you know, you can be really ungrounded. And so I was in this place of connecting these historical developmental ideas about how science and philosophy worked with a dabbling across lots of fields because I was just interested in how everything fit together. And, you know, very quickly I was drawn to chaos theory and complexity science. And this took me on a path eventually to grad school in atmospheric science, where I found I could study complexity by studying the formation of clouds using satellite images of the Earth. And just as it turned out, the dynamic feedbacks of clouds for the climate system are one of the biggest sources of uncertainty. So they're hugely important for climate science. And it's also a place where it's pattern formation left and right. So a great place to study complexity. And as I was learning these things, I kept feeling drawn back to my philosophical roots. Questions about what is real and knowable? How good are your methods? Do you have a philosophical foundation for how you determine what is real and what can be measured so that your measurement framework is legitimate? And there were lots of problems with using fractal models, fractal dimension estimation, for characterizing the dynamic mixing processes in clouds. So it was a very practical problem that had an esoteric component, and there was some very bad method being used. So my master's degree was a critique of method. As a physicist doing atmospheric science, really I was being an epistemologist, like an applied philosopher. And the other thing that happened during this time that really led me further was I spent 3 years deeply learning climate science. And that's a very depressing and traumatizing thing to experience, to learn how the world is changing, to learn how big and complex it is, And this was happening in 2002, 2003, 2004, which is also when the United States was invading Iraq under false pretenses. And so I would sit in my office at the University of Illinois, where I was going to grad school, look out my window and watch the students walking by on campus and reflect on this big perception gap. You know, we're supposedly at war, invading Iraq. And I look around and there's no evidence of war among any of the students or any part of US culture. And this gap of perception, exactly the same thing was happening with climate change. There was this big complex systemic problem and a huge gap of perception. People living out their daily lives as if it's not happening. And I was immediately aware, like, this is a huge problem. And just happened, one of my good friends was in grad school studying the cognitive anthropology of religion. So cognitive science and ethnographic research to look at religious thought and behavior. And I was talking with him one day. He said, Joe, what you're describing with this problem of perception, that's cognitive science. You should go and study some cognitive science. And it just so happens that I put together a reading list of books on cognitive science. Would you like me to send it to you? So I dropped out of my PhD program in atmospheric science and started studying cognitive science on my own. Spent about 2 years, read 70 or 80 books, 300 or 400 research articles. And the problem I wanted to solve was the problem of behavior relating to climate change. So unlike getting a PhD in psychology, doing personality research, or animal behavior, where you're looking at cognitive processing in the visual cortex of a fruit fly or something, you know, where you'd have these very disciplinary programmatic ways of learning, I had a problem-based real-world focus. This huge complex problem in the world, a huge amount of knowledge relevant to it, and I'm just going to meander. And I'm going to try to connect the dots. Just happened that I had read a lot of work by George Lakoff during that time, which enabled me to make a compelling interview to get a research position at the think tank he had set up in Berkeley. So I was able to go and work with him for about a year doing cognitive linguistics research. So we were studying language, written, spoken, and gestural language to deconstruct political worldviews as they related to political discourse in the United States. And so we spent several years afterwards doing this kind of deconstruct the thought patterns of people through language to help nonprofits and social movements to be more effective. And already having a complexity science background, the ecosystem of media with social media and what was happening, the ecosystems of organizations and their affiliations and alliances and incentive structures, all of those were just really evident. So I gradually came to the realization that I was doing cultural evolution research, that I was studying how social systems evolve moment to moment. I had been looking at it through a kind of semantic lens. How do people construct their thoughts and how does that shape their behaviors? But it turned out that all of it was complex systems. So you could use complex systems to translate between different fields. Here's a place where there are instabilities. How do the instabilities arise? In this case, it's because these groups don't cooperate because their mental categories create a perception of opposition when they're actually aligned. Or things like this that were dynamic instabilities, and you could just translate. So this is how I ended up doing work on the science of large-scale social change, was seeing that as I went down this rabbit hole, every step of the way, we knew somewhere within different sciences or research areas, we knew exactly what was needed to solve the problem. But it was fragmented, it wasn't integrated, it wasn't being translated into practice. The institutions of practice themselves were fragmented in ways they couldn't receive it. And so, that's kind of become my work in many ways, is translate scientific knowledge for social change efforts.
Yeah, you wrote this article on Medium that talked about why even the most intellectual, you know, well-educated people have trouble wrapping their heads around climate change and global collapse issues. Even though they might cognitively accept it as that's something that's happening or likely to happen, they can't actively engage in it. They can't change their lives to match the situation and they can't process it emotionally. So can you get into that a little bit?
Sure. Let me start with a really foundational book. Descartes' Error, written by Antonio Damasio, came out in 1994. And Antonio Damasio is a neuroscientist who studies emotions as they relate to decision-making. So the book Descartes' Error is, the name even tells you, separating mind from body or reason from emotion is a fundamental error. And it turns out that if the part of your brain that is processing emotions becomes damaged from a car accident or a debilitating neurological disease, that you lose the ability to make effective decisions. So now let's connect this way of thinking to climate change. What happens when we observe through a lot of different information that human behavior is causing extinctions, is destroying beautiful landscapes, is threatening our future? And now say maybe you're a parent and you have a child. So you are complicit in one way or another. You might drive a car. You might have a big house that uses a lot of energy. And lots of things you might do that make you complicit in the destruction of the future, which means you're responsible for harming your own child at some point in the future. So you have these kinds of very emotionally intense and painful kinds of experiences. Well, one thing that we know from research on, like, for example, research in anthropology for what's called terror management theory, is that human beings have a psychological capacity to imagine the future and then experience emotional responses on that future that affect our behaviors today. So we can do things like imagine our own eventual death. And this can create anxiety and terror, so we need psychological mechanisms to manage that anxiety and terror. So terror management theory is a way of thinking about human behavior and motivation as it connects to the emotional connection between the present and the future. What we see with climate change is that the anxiety about the future is experienced in the present. The behaviors that are needed to change the future are behaviors we act out in the present. But because most of our feelings about the future are negative, anxiety, shame, grief, despair, anger, humiliation, these feelings then play out in our behaviors in the present. So the only way for us to behave appropriately in the present is to go through a grieving process and develop ways of managing trauma. But in this case, it's trauma that is evoked by thoughts of the future. And it might be connected to our own experiences in the past. Like we may have been harmed in the way we were parented or by some events or experiences we had when we were younger, but we're experiencing it as an imagined future. So the real challenge is to bring a therapeutic approach to managing our identity in the future to our emotions about the present, and that is grief therapy. So what most of our academic research does is it trains us to presume separation. This idea of objectification includes protecting our own emotions from the object of study. And we even call it the object of study. Remove the subject from the research. So if I study the climate system as an object, I've just protected myself emotionally, and terror management theory explains why. As if I experience climate change from an intersubjective position, how do I subjectively relate to this world? It evokes fear, anxiety, shame, grief, pain, etc. So this is the place where the work needs to be done. And honestly, this isn't the work of the scientists. You know, this isn't what scientists are being asked to do when they're doing their research. And so this is the main place where the behavior change breaks down.
Yeah, this to me seems really related to, are you familiar with integral theory with Ken Wilber, spiral dynamics, yes, all of that? Yeah. So this to me seems to be very much related to the chasm between the green level and the higher levels. So teal, mm-hmm, and then yellow was added later, but let's just say teal.
We should define that. So people who don't know what those colors are.
For those who don't know, the green level is the sensitive self. So that's the consideration for others. Relational qualities are appreciated higher than logic and systems, or they integrate logic and systems, but also include kind of emotional aspects, caring for others, caring for the earth, wanting everybody to be equal and protected. And then the teal level, which is kind of the global post-rationalist kind of meta-rationalist thinking that includes all systems, all previous levels, and, is able to see contradictions, is able to see paradox. And between them is this chasm of great anguish and nihilism. And the reason why most people are unable to cross it is because it is so emotionally challenging. Unlike the previous kind of upgrades where there isn't as much emotional anguish, this particular upgrade seems to be impossible to achieve without emotional anguish. And so, yeah, that seems to be very much related to what you're talking about. In this case, like you have to integrate the feelings with the systems, with the data, and that's where the challenge comes in.
Yeah, there's the comment I'd made earlier about martial arts giving me a way to practice working with my body to make sense of things. A beautiful accident of doing that, meaning it wasn't the intention when I started, was that I learned how to work with my emotions in order to behave effectively while also being strategic. So if you think about relaxed gaze, that you have relaxed gaze when you're sparring with someone, or if you've ever done team sports like playing basketball or volleyball or soccer, you have this relaxed gaze, which is you are alert and poised, ready for action, but you're scanning the field for different things that are changing. So if you're playing soccer, for example, you look down the field, see other players, and you're moving the ball while they're moving at the same time. So relaxed gaze is a kind of alert action or preparation for alert action that combines emotion and reasoning. So this is one of the places where that chasm is, there's preparation for crossing the chasm and developing that kind of ability. So team sports or body-based practice can help prepare people for crossing the chasm. But the other thing that is really essential for this and the integral theory framework is that we get to the level of green through social support systems. Like, for example, you don't learn physics going and studying physics from someone. And so you end up having a social support system for your education that gets you to the place where you can really handle the reasoning and the logic and the ethic of care. The ethic of care in part comes from your relationship with the other people who supported your learning along the way. And so these things are connected in the pedagogy of that learning process. But to cross from green to teal, there's this piece that's like being born, where, you know, when you're being born as a placental mammal, I don't want to overgeneralize and humanize and say reptiles don't do this the same way. But as a placental mammal, to be born means you go from being inside your mother or you're interdependent to having a dangerous and scary solitary existence. You're birthed out of the body and now you're on your own. And in a very important way, as a metaphorical way, that the chasm between green and teal is the same, that you have to go through this change by yourself without the social supports, because it's a breakdown of meaning within yourself and you lose the ability to relate to your peers socially as you're going through it. And I think this is an unacknowledged piece, is that people who have gotten really good at working with others find out that they're not good at working with others about this anguish they're experiencing. And no one has told them that this is okay or that this is normal. And that it's supposed to be lonely and scary and isolating. And this relates back to something that's been observed by many people who work with indigenous communities, that there are rites of passage, there are induction rituals that are structured to do this exact thing, create the social supports to prepare a person to go on a dangerous personal journey, to leave the group, return to the group transformed as an adult. Joseph Campbell named this the hero's journey when he analyzed it in lots of cultures. It's this exact process. And so if more people knew that there are elders or adults who are on the other side who have survived it. They'll tolerate the fear, uncertainty, the danger of it, because they know that it's survivable. If they see others going through it at the same time as a cohort, even though it's solitary for each of them as individuals, then they have people that they can talk to in the confusion and the anguish. And that creates a kind of therapeutic support system for the isolation and confusion, which Indigenous cultures do. So this is one of our big challenges, is that in the modern world, because of colonialism and extractive mindsets and domination empire worldviews, we've stamped out and destroyed, undermined, and devalued the practices of Indigenous cultures, when their practices are exactly what we need to cross this chasm. And so, I think you really named it very well, that the emotional challenge of becoming a confident, capable person, and then finding the things you are able to do normally don't serve you, and then not being able to talk to other people about it, because the skills that are broken down are those skills of communication and relating. Well, that's all part of it. That's all that should be normalized as part of it.
Yeah. I think there's another part of this too, where people don't know that there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It, also because of the missing tribal aspect and the rites of passage. We don't know that there, at the end of that chasm of nihilism, there is light. There is a place where you can be effective once again. And I think that's probably why people kind of step away from the edge.
Or if they're in it, the nihilism just seems like it's never ending.
Yeah.
It seems that there's nothing beyond it. And especially because it's now been named nihilism, as like, as if it's a legitimate philosophy and not a transitionary phase. Some people think, well, I guess I'm just a nihilist.
Yeah, it's, and unfortunately, because, you know, when I mentioned terror management theory, there's a broader way of describing it, which is the challenge that the human animal has, because we have these amazing cognitive abilities for perceiving the imagined future, that we have a need to manage the anxiety of ourselves. And so there is a broad set of psychological mechanisms to help us escape from ourselves, to escape from the difficulties, the psychological burdens of having a self. And this is something that non-human animals, for the most part, we don't have evidence that they need to deal with. And if any of them do, it might be like elephants or dolphins or whales. You know, there would be some animals that do it. They would probably all be mammals. But it's really difficult to gather evidence for it. So we don't have much evidence for it. But this idea that we need to escape ourselves. So what does it mean to play games? You play games to create a diversion, which is very healthy. If you're playing a game to ignore the fact that you're hungry, that actually can help you cope and survive. If you have anxiety and you can't sleep at night, it might be worthwhile to get on Netflix and watch some stupid movie just to distract yourself. So escaping from ourselves is a really important piece of being human. Unfortunately, there are a huge number of traps. We can escape from ourselves and then not deal with our problems. And climate change is a gigantic, I mean, I would even say the ecological crisis, bigger than climate change. It's an example of escapism by a million routes, because people don't know how to deal with it. And to get to the other side of this chasm requires us to do something in preparation before we cross the chasm. And that is to identify the sacred. If we identify the sacred, and I mean in a very personal way, what is sacred to me as an individual person who is going through a crisis, so that when I get to nihilism, I don't just commit suicide. Basically, I have something sacred that I'm responsible to that is bigger than myself. So my problems of nihilism come from my relationship to myself. So I need something that I conceive as more foundational than myself, that I'm in service to. And then I will tolerate the nihilism. I will tolerate the depression to be of service to it. Now, let me make this really concrete. I have a 2-year-old daughter. My wife and I chose to have a child knowing what the future holds. So now I have something sacred the thing that's sacred is I'm responsible for my child's future while she's a child, because I consciously made the choice to have a child. So what is sacred is my self-concept of fatherhood. So I have a part of myself that is connected to the sacred. So now I have an anchor of self. So now when I go through nihilism and I have a crisis of self, part of myself is anchored to the sacred. And in the last 2 years, I crossed this chasm myself. So this is recent for me. And the trigger for really entering it was when my wife became pregnant after we'd made the decision to have a child. So I began, and just like studying martial arts earlier in life, I didn't plan it this way. I didn't design it this way. But looking backward, this is exactly what happened. I found an anchor of the sacred that I needed to serve that was part of myself, so that when I felt a totally screwed up connection to the rest of the world, I could find my way by connecting to what it was like to hold my daughter when she was 3 months old. You know, so I would have this body-based anchor to the sacred in a relationship to a part of myself that allowed me to stay in the nihilism until eventually I matured, till eventually I got to the other side. And this, I think, is a really powerful lesson here. People can prepare themselves by finding the sacred. And the way they do this is by finding what they feel service to that is bigger than themselves. But it helps them find the part of themselves that's connected to it. And that combination is the magic. So
What I'm somewhat afraid of with that is that only out of my own personal experience of not having that, of going through that nihilism and not having any kind of anchor. And to me, and probably just because it's my perspective, it feels like that kind of no safety net flying off the cliff into the void feeling is one of the only ways I could imagine going through that without grasping to whatever attachment I could find that would keep me sane and kind of keep me from really exploring as deep as I could have gone.
Yeah.
Am I making sense here? I don't know what you think about this. Like, because I know that it was kind of the same for you, not having something to hold on to.
Yeah. And at least not consciously. I've also consciously let go of all of my attachments and deconstructed all of myself until there was basically nothing except just I am, I exist. But every other statement was just no longer accurate. But there are, you know, nonverbal and non-logical parts of me that still had an appreciation for our relationship, an appreciation for nature and hope for the future, you know, appreciation for beauty and things like that, these transcendent values that also kind of helped me transition, even though I didn't consciously select them beforehand. But I do agree with you that I think maybe if you didn't consciously select them beforehand, you will find them in your darkest hour.
Yeah, I didn't consciously select them for myself either. But I think there's something that, you know, we've mentioned Jonathan Haidt earlier. John Haidt's earlier book, The Happiness Hypothesis, he has a section where he looks at contemporary psychological research as it relates to attachment and then critiques Buddhism and non-attachment. And what he finds is that there are healthy attachments and unhealthy attachments, and that we need to have a nuanced view of this. Mm-hmm. So to deconstruct the self is part of it is to find the real attachments. And I don't mean the attachments in the Buddhist language, I mean attachments in the psychological language. That there are things that gave us the foundations of emotional health and social capability as biological organisms.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Those attachments are very essential for navigating the chasm.
Right.
But the word attachment can be confusing if you're thinking about it through a Buddhist lens. So I just wanted to recognize that the attachment as a word could be confusing here.
Right.
And yeah, I don't think it's totally for the right. three of us, but I think at a conversational level, it could be confusing.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah. The Buddhist view of attachment is more your attachment to ideas or roles. Mm-hmm. Whereas you're talking about attachment in like, you know,
an evolutionary.
Evolutionary and kind of developmental psychology like Piaget theory.
Yeah, exactly.
Where it's like your healthy way of relating to things that are not you.
Yeah. And to go through one of these and these initiation rituals without preparation is, it's not quite suicide, but it's extremely dangerous.
It can so, definitely lead to that, yeah.
And or in hunter-gatherer societies, there's a lot of very active parenting for young children that creates strong psychosocial developmental attachments. So the children have a lot of cultural and emotional and physical development preparation for initiation rituals, which in the modern world, our education systems and our ways of parenting are mostly inadequate. Some places they do it well, but a lot of places they don't. So if we think of it as if a person has been helped to become ready for an initiation, then crossing the chasm, it's not that it's easier, because we know the word easy is not appropriate to nihilism, but it is facilitated so that it is able to function more effectively as they go through this crossing the chasm process. And even if they don't feel it internally, they're actually more capable and they come through on the other side. They're more likely to succeed at getting through to the other side. And so I think that's an important piece of this as well, to think in terms of education, what needs to be done now with young people so that when they get to the place that they are going into this developmental transition in their own lives, that they've been prepared for it. And in what ways are they not being prepared now? Yeah.
All right, that was it for part one of our interview with Joe Brewer. To get all the links and show notes, go to futurethinkers.org/90. In part two, we will continue our conversation and go into rites of passage that are suitable for young people today, as well as how humanity can create regenerative cultures and lead itself through the approaching evolutionary transition. And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Our new course, The Ancient Art of Adulting, is here, adapting age-old wisdom for a modern life of purpose and meaning. Register now at courses.futurethinkers.org.
Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.